You're listening to the Rural Advancement Podcast. Rural Advancement provides resources to empower, equip, and encourage rural pastors and churches. Join our community by visiting us at ruraladvancement.com.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Rural Advancement. This is the podcast that is by rural leaders and for rural leaders. It is our goal every single week, week in and week out, to bring you content that is not just spoken to the rural church, but is spoken by people who get it, people who have lived, worked, and ministered in small, out-of-the-way places, and people who understand the immense value of the work that God has done there. I am your host, Joe Epley, and today we get to dive into part two of a conversation with Pastor Nick Rogers, who hails to us from Texas. In part one, which was last week, if you haven't listened to it yet, you get to hear kind of Nick's story. You get to hear how he, originally jumped into this small town and began to revitalize the church and really saw God do amazing things as he found every opportunity to kind of pastor the town, even beyond just pastoring his church. And so we left off last week with this delightful conversation about county museums and how they can really be a cornerstone of rural ministry in a way. But now we get to dive into further conversations about the ins and outs of, you know, what does it look like to engage with, you know, economic development? What does it look like to, you know, why is it important to upkeep your church building? What does benevolence look like? And really just get into broader and broader conversations. And so without further ado, here is part two. Let's do this. Let's talk about church facilities. This is a fun one. So you mentioned, and here's the thing, because I'm going to paint the picture for you. Number one, I think in small towns, money's always tight, like perpetually. Yes. You know, it's just like a trait of what we do. And so you've kind of got this moment where you probably have a church. It's probably got some things wrong with it, you know, lights that don't work and pipes that are a little leaky and things that are squeaky and shouldn't be squeaky and all those things. And a new pastor coming in might look at that scenario and be like, well, we barely have the money to pay the bills and you know, pay the pastor, let alone upgrade the church in any meaningful way or whatever. And so, but I know that you said, hey, you know, we started with the parking lot like this and I was mowing it and then we were able to put down this nice rock mix on it and like make it better and just do these small things to improve the quality of the building itself. So again, simple question, why should a pastor care? What does that accomplish in a congregation when you invest meaningfully into the facility? Because some people would say, well, the church isn't a building, it's the people. And it's like, but why do buildings still matter? That's my question.
That's fantastic. So in rural context, any kind of visible progress, it makes waves, right? Mm-hmm. It just does because it's something that has changed. Something changes. In rural context, so many things never change, right? Yeah. The courthouse may get an update every 100 years or whatever it is.
Right, right. On the centennial, obviously.
Yeah. And that's it. Oh, it's going to get the update or whatever. So in rural context, generally very few things change. And so when people see change happening, it actually builds some momentum. Now, the problem is in a rural context too, which this is what we found ourselves in. Oftentimes we were having to work on things, sometimes it was visible, but more often than not, it was invisible things because it was like, we had a couple of air conditioners from the 1970s. And I mean, we were putting old parts in it. We were doing this and the Freon and everything else. I mean, our claim to fame for one of our air conditioner units in our very small sanctuary, we had two, but the way it was designed, we needed both of them because neither one of them worked right. But anyway, I went to AutoZone and I got a belt that went to a Cadillac from AutoZone.
There you go.
And that's what ran our air conditioner for a couple of years was that belt. Because so you got to be creative, right? And I wouldn't consider myself a handyman, but I'm not a handyman. But rural notices progress, and so We were able to, over a 7 year period, maybe it was even less than that, 6 year period, we were able to put rock in for our parking lot. We also joined in. We made all kinds of connections with different civic groups. Girl Scouts, we worked with them hand in hand. Girl Scouts West Texas, it was awesome. And anyway, they ended up doing a significant donation to help put some rocks and boulders around our church sign. We had this little tiny church sign, but still, it amped up that little corner of the property. We were on the second busiest thoroughfare of our town, and so it was a big deal, sprucing up. We had river rock. It was a whole, in a very semi-arid climate, we had river rock around. It was very nice. So the Girl Scouts helped us out doing the caliche twice. We had different groups come and help us with the caliche, and we had different ones that help us make sure put down the proper
Which,
types of
to
poison.
be clear, this caliche is basically Oklahoma and Texas speak for like a rock scorio parking lot, like a road mix style. Gravel and,
it's not crushed asphalt, because that's a whole that's
Oh yeah,
another
that's no, that's
level of
different energy.
niceness, right? And so
Yeah, we don't make
and
that much money,
yeah, exactly. And so we were able to do that, but we at times we got donations and different things, obviously. But even the parsonage had some challenges. We had some churches donate to put central heat in there. It never had that before. But even around town, anytime we had a heat and air guy, everybody knew. So it was really cool, the location of our small church. Everybody knew what we had going on. And we always had like Mondays were our big day where people could come and get help and all of that. And so the bank people always knew what we had going on. The county sheriff and his deputies always knew. It was just awesome. But the word is progress, is when you have something visibly changing or tangible in front of the community, they're like, well, something's going on there. I mean, we've got countless stories. Some of them are, heart-wrenching, obviously. One of them is a lady that I don't know that I ever met before. She was working at a 24-hour convenience store. A trucker had dropped off another lady at that convenience store. Let everybody else finish the story on that. And the lady at the convenience store said that this the lady working the convenience store is like 2 a.m. in the morning, whatever, 1 a.m. And this lady said, "Well, where can I go to even go get help?" And this lady said, "Well, there's a church and there's a pastor that lives next door, and they're the only people I know you can like knock on their door."
Wow, and that's really cool, right? Like that's a reputation thing of just like, man, we got to dive into this, you know?
So that so but all that speaks to progress. All that speaks to helping one another, and helping those in need. And honestly, it speaks to last story is when I was in the hospital. A few months in, well, weeks in of living there, I was just looking around at the hospital, meeting people at the hospital, so that way I could do the whole chaplain thing, not paid, just be able to go in and pray with people. And I noticed there was a map from the early mid 80s. It was one of those cartoon maps of the city, of the town. And on the block that which is a main thoroughfare, there was an empty green spot where our church exists that's been there for 3 or 4 decades. And I'm like, people don't even, we've been here for decades. And in the cartoon map, they did not know that church existed. And so progress matters.
I also think of it through terms of ownership. You think of a lot of rural towns and like resources are limited, and a lot of times rural congregations and communities kind of want to know that, like, if you come in from the outside, you might say, well, what's so special about this pew, this property, this rock, this sign, whatever? And they're like, well, it's special because it's the only one we got, and we can't necessarily afford a new one, so take care of it. And it's just, and I love that, like, when you invest in a church facility, especially in a rural setting, you're not just saying, hey, let's make the building more functional, but you're saying, I care enough about the place that I live to make permanent upgrades to it. And like for people who understand that language of assets and why they matter and why they're so scarce, like I think you can send such a powerful message of like I there was a pastor, there was a small town in Montana where they just experienced transients in the pulpit, like often can happen in a small town. So they had just pastor after pastor. And the first pastor
got in a board meeting and basically said, "Hey guys, just so you know, I'm going to be moving out of the parsonage," which of course causes this big scare. And he says, "Well, I'm buying a house in the community." And literally this congregation, it like changed overnight. They were just like, you mean you care enough to like intentionally want to put down roots here?" And it just speaks of like a permanence and an investment that I think people latch on to. Man, that's cool stuff.
Absolutely.
That's
Yeah,
cool
yeah.
stuff.
And you know, decorating your church for Christmas, right? And so we did that. You know, we put Christmas lights out. We had a lady in the county that could do paint on glass, right? And so we
Yeah.
did this big mural thing on our two double doors that had glass and so all those kind of things that typically don't cost a lot. One last thing, just
Yeah.
We had a lot of instead of grass where there should have been like some kind of grass. Again, we're in a semi-arid climate, but we still had areas of what would be considered yard, but it was loaded with like sticker weeds and stickers, all kind various kinds and whatever. And we live in an area of like where tumbleweeds can get started and all of that.
Yeah.
So we had live tumbleweeds living, and so for the first few years, and I'd have people do it alongside we men, teenage boys, my son, but we would just pick weeds, and because we didn't have a lot of money for anything else, but we could remove what was there and spruce it up. And the bushes that the church had, they were all like all over the place. And once we moved in, we get, you know, trimmed up the bushes, you know, just things like that.
Yeah.
And so all of that matters. And people notice upkeep. We put a banner bought a, you know, I think it was $100-something, $200 banner. And we put it, mounted it on the side of the building just because we couldn't afford to do anything on the outside of the building, like spruce it up. So I'm
Right.
like, a clean looking banner would look great, and
There
so
you go,
that's
a
what we
couple
did.
$100, you know,
Yeah.
and I love that because it's accessible. It's like I can pick weeds, we can get a couple rocks, we can put up a $100 banner. Like it doesn't have to be high resource things.
Correct.
Well, let's talk about the next one, economic development. So this one is near and dear to my heart. My wife spent 7 years as the head of an economic development nonprofit where I was the youth pastor and she was doing community development throughout our county and other counties. And I personally am familiar with kind of this cool benefit that comes from the community development side of being involved. But I want to hear your perspective. Give us maybe the shorter version of how you really got involved in economic development, but then give us the longer version of kind of what benefits you saw from that on the church side and the community side of like, why did it matter so much? How did it propel the cause forward in a sense?
Okay, yeah. So through getting to be friends with the Chamber of Commerce crowd, I said, "Hey, is there anything I can do at City Hall?" And they said, "Well, we just I you know, I was told that they were trying to hire a college intern to help at City Hall, the economic developer." And I dabbled that in that a little bit in a previous lifetime there in Albuquerque with the economic developer, the city of Albuquerque, and it's a wild story. But anyway, so I've kind of been in that world a little bit with the state of New Mexico as well. And so I'm like, well, this is cool. I could do this, you know, help out with that there. So anyway, show up at City Hall and I said, "Hey, the Chamber of Commerce director sent me over here. I'm here to, you know, here to volunteer and help you." And he's like, "Well, I don't need a volunteer, and I need a he's not he wasn't from West Texas, so he was a little bit interesting character. Got to do ministry in that context, obviously, as well. But he said, "I don't need a volunteer. I need a college intern." And I'm like, and so like I flipped the script there. And at this point, I also have a master's degree, bachelor's degree, and I'm like, okay. I was like, well, I said, "You don't have any college interns applying or college students applying. So I'm here. So sign me up for $10 an hour, and I'll serve you. You know, I'll serve you,
Done,
and I'll
yeah.
serve economic development." And it took a little bit. It was an interesting dynamic. And anyway, because he did not trust me at all. He didn't trust pastors. He didn't trust
Sure,
Christians.
sure.
But anyway, so I jumped in, and it does take a humility to do that. There has to
Yeah.
be humility when you show up at City Hall as a smaller, you know, rural pastor church or whatever. Anyway, I show up and I say, "Hey, I'm here to volunteer." And then I take on this internship thing and or intern role, and he treated me like an intern for that first year. But then after that, things it was just marvelous way of how God
Of
did
the
it all.
Lordy, yeah.
He did it all, but But yeah, so I went there. Out of that, I'm trying to look at all my notes because I was like, okay, what all was I involved in? You know, when it remember pastoring the town, pastoring the county, posture of humility, right? So I go in, and so economic development is really you're just trying to have take all the local strengths of your community and your county and make it to where somehow you are able to give grants to businesses that already operate in your town or county or those that are looking. And then it kind of there's a ripple effect beyond that where you're doing all kinds of things. Like for me, let's see, I located properties that were for sale or needed to be for sale. I helped, we worked, I worked on a, on this, community center. It still never was built as a binder about this thick. Essentially, all I did was on that, it was going to be a winery and all kinds of other things. And all I did was is think, all right, well, if I was to plant a church and it was going to be this size, what all would I do out of the church? And so I was like, let's do a community. And so anyway, it was essentially just me doing my church planting plan that I would have done in Albuquerque. That's what I introduced in a city hall meeting
I
with
love
that.
that.
It was awesome, but it was this thick. It was so cool. I worked on a city park that had to do with some economics as well. And so I was the lead in that for over a year with all kinds of different people. And anyway, so that so ne then we could kind of unpack from there.
Yeah, so talk about again, economic development is a cool because it frequently just involves getting to know your community more. It involves kind of breathing life wherever you can find it in your
Yes.
community. And so maybe let's take it this route. If a pastor wanted to take steps into kind of being a part of that world as part of their ministry to their small town, what would be the first couple steps to like jumping into that world?
Yeah, so there are ways in which you can educate yourself in that world. There's also just now you have to tap into it. You have to do the research. You can't just fall into it. I mean, in
Yeah,
one
can't
sense,
charisma that stuff, you know? So.
right. In one sense, I sort of fell into it, but really not because I showed up at City Hall and said, "What can I do?" But I mean, anyway, there are conferences for economic development and in particular that have a rural context to it. And I have attended I think one, two, three of those during my time in my town. It's named Brownfield, Texas. And so I did do that. So what you can do is avail yourself, go attend one of those conferences, but you can just go and meet the current economic developer. And there are schools, and when I say schools, D1 universities that have certification programs in economic development. Usually, at least where in the region where I'm at, Texas, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Louisiana, this Arkansas. At times, you almost have to have somebody, not a benefactor, but you have to have somebody sign off for you. It's
Right.
kind of like, yeah, you have to have like somebody, but it is available. And I think the natural pastors naturally do rural economic development already
Right.
because I
If
don't
you
know
look
how
at
to.
it's, let's see, fundraising, community events, inspiring people to a common cause, administrating events, like you can, like, there's tons of overlap in this world. Yeah.
Well, and you're wanting to stabilize industries in a community or stabilize movements or stabilize like businesses, nonprofits, all of those kind of things, and all kind of works together. Economic development is about building up a skilled workforce. And so so I got to work in that world, which is really super
Which is
cool
kind of
too.
discipleship, really. You know, like it's,
Yes, it
again,
is.
these all these things overlap, you know.
Life coaching. There's definitely some life coaching, how to write resumes, how to interview. Improving quality of life is a big deal in rural America, and economic development is that's kind of one of the movements of that. Okay, well, how can we improve quality of life? Well, it's through stabilization of job and workforce and education and small scale entrepreneurship, right? And grants for that, which is provided by state and federal entities. But you have to help connect all the dots, which is what we do as in ministry anyway. We connect dots for Jesus. And so,
Yeah. And so what I hear you saying from the very beginning is Make yourself available, get to know the people in your community who are in this sphere, and be willing to learn. And if you find that the door or that crack in the wall is open wide enough, you can go as deep into it as you want. You can pursue education, you can pursue certifications. Like, I think the myth of economic development is that it's not accessible because it feels like a specialization. It feels like, and there is some knowledge to it, but at the core of it, you as a pastor are saying, I want to partner with the people whose job it is to make our community better. And
Absolutely.
that's the heartbeat piece that keeps you going, even as you kind of maybe jump in at this administrative point or jump in with this event or jump in with this internship or jump in with an eventual certification. And so, so thanks for sharing your experience there. And I love that that kind of became one of the avenues through which you got to love and help your community. So. Well, we have three questions left here, and this is where it starts to branch off of just different things that popped out of your story. But let's talk benevolence, right? Because I think again, small towns have a lot of weirdly, because you think of cities when you think of like transient or homeless populations, but small towns get a lot of drifters, like a lot of people rolling
Yes.
through, a lot of people that, yeah, like you say, got dropped off at a truck stop, and you're just like, what in the world? And so I would argue, and I think a lot of good smart books would argue that there's like the quote unquote right way to help somebody, there's the wrong way to help somebody. And so as a rural pastor, you're gonna get hit up with this stuff constantly of, somebody needs help with rent, some family needs a car to a gas station, some family's out of groceries. How do you, somebody needs a night in a hotel just to sober
Yeah.
up, like how do you responsibly do benevolence in a small town setting?
Okay, so there's three really areas on this that I want to, there's like your own church and how you
Sure.
approach it, right? And then honestly, there's the part, at least in rural context, where the local police department is involved, the city, and people know what, like the city officials, city council, like there's a lot of levels to where everybody just knows what's happening in that world, because that same world is the same one that like our community we were in. For instance, the electricity was all re electricity bills were ran through City Hall in the city of Brownfield. So
Sure.
therefore, right, I just thought of this a while ago. I'm like, well, January, there's probably going to be anywhere from 300 to 400 family unit electrical cutoffs because of their, we call them cutoffs, because of them spending too much over Christmas and not having enough money to pay their electric bill in January. And so there's those components. So there's your church, how it approaches it. There's the how the city and how you can come alongside them and how they approach it. And then the third one, this is the best part of it, is the ministerial alliance. I was blessed with a cohesive ministerial alliance that at any given time, 6 to 9 pastors, we were always all in. Now we had all these
Sure.
other pastors, they drop in or churches or whatever, but
But you
there
had a
was,
good core group, if you will.
we had a good core group. And of course, when I found out there was a ministerial alliance, I dived in, no matter how uncomfortable it might have been at first,
Yep,
right?
no matter how much you were speaking in tongues as a Pentecostal
Yeah,
and the Lutherans are
exactly.
side-eyeing you,
Yeah,
so.
exactly. Well, and even a well-to-do other denominational guy was in charge of the money. And as far as I know, he still is now.
Sure.
And at first, I was, anyway, he's my buddy now. Let's just put it that
Right,
way.
right, right. But you have to work your way into these things, and it
He was
matters.
not
Yeah.
my buddy originally,
Yeah, I
as the
feel that.
treasurer of the Ministerial Alliance. Anyway, out of that, so I want to, the context of this is, I'm trying to go through it as quick as possible, is the context, find a Ministerial Alliance, jump in. It may or may not be fruitful, but you jump in regardless. I ended up being able to serve as the president of our Ministerial Alliance. And out of that, I was able to utilize the tools that I picked up throughout other contexts of ministry, including my time with the city of Albuquerque in the state of New Mexico, where I was able to teach on how to handle benevolence needs in a small church setting. And it was, trust me, it was because I fell on my face a whole bunch of times. It was not because I'm brilliant. It was because, or is because I had all the answers for this little community
Sure.
out in the, 890 square mile county. It was because God had humbled me and God had taken me through and taught me the lessons so that way I could help others, including pastors of other churches. So Ministerial Alliance, we were able to do a training and ongoing, it's ongoing still even to this day, where we train all the new pastors that want to help with Ministerial Alliance on how to handle benevolence and how to approach it. We also started, we communicated a lot more as a Ministerial Alliance with pastors. If somebody showed up at one church, we'd shoot off a group email and
Hey,
we
we
would,
saw this person. Just, if
yeah,
they come
they're,
asking for the 10th help on their rent bill,
right, exactly. Their rent, their electricity, or they need food. And we were like, yeah, we've already helped that person 3 times this year. Or, I mean, this is a repeat offender, so to speak. Or
Sure,
this is
sure.
somebody, the best ones were the ones we've never heard about. And somebody's like, yeah, I know their aunt. And this person's never asked for help that we know of ever. And we're like, whatever we got to do.
Yeah,
What
let's do
do they
it.
need? $229 for their electric bill. Let's come
Done, yeah.
alongside them, right? There was an older lady, her plumbing busted underneath her mobile home. It was a polar vortex freeze kind of scenario. Never happened before. She didn't know she was losing water. She owed the city $600, and on and on and on.
Dang.
We all come together on those kind of moments, say, how can we help this lady? And of course, we also do consultation. We require them to come to the, we ended up using the church I pastored as headquarters for all these moments. We called it Intake Monday. We changed it. We gave it a little bit more of a context where it felt a little bit more professional. We called it intake, but in the end, the goal was to tell them about Jesus. The goal was to make sure that they knew there was a church that would accept them in town, as if the, however they rolled in, whatever that looked like. And we prayed with them, and then we would talk to them about how we could help them. And so, because we did have some churches that donated to the Ministerial Alliance that had means, and some of us that didn't, so those the churches like my church rarely ever gave to the Ministerial Alliance because we couldn't afford to. But we
Sure.
hosted it. We hosted the food pantry,
Yep.
and we hosted all the people in need, ones that we knew by name, and ones that we'd never met before, and all the different things. Ones that were driving better vehicles than me, but
Sure.
needed food from the food pantry. Anyway, all those kind of things. And so, anyway, benevolence as a church. So I've got the thought about benevolence as a church. You want me to share that, Joe,
Yeah,
or?
let's do that. Just kind of your maybe your best guiding principle of like, if I'm a local church pastor, how am I? Because I think people can already pull some of this stuff, like, oh, should I be concerned about who's a repeat offender? Should I be vetting these things with other people in my town? Like, those are all great things, but maybe one more kind of best practice as a local pastor of just like, hey, how do I handle these needs as they come across my desk?
Well, when you have a church that most of your people make an hourly wage, and even some of them live in Section 8 housing, they are going to have needs within your church. And what you've got to do is you've got to develop, like, and really be like, we are here for you. With this church family is here for you. But you also have to kind of make it in a context where, and even out of all this, we still ended up losing people over the years because no matter what you give, some families think that you should give more, and even if it's astronomical amount. But what you really need to do is nail down, like, for your church and make it like kind of public knowledge and be
Right,
like,
almost
hey,
like a like you would you call it like a policy of just like here's the
correct.
rules that guide us with every interaction, not just with
Right,
this
right.
person and that person and that person.
Right, right. You have to have that, but you also have to know there's the letter of the law and the spirit of the law,
Sure.
and you got to be able to flow with that. But people need to know that, like, you're number one. If you can't take care of your church, you can't take care of the town. And so that's where the pastoring the town and pastoring your church
Yeah, it
live.
flips, yeah.
But if you're not taking care of your church, then who cares about if you're reaching the town because you're not being able to take care of the single mom that has a couple of kids that's in Section 8 housing, and she needs all she needs is $131 to get her through the month.
Yeah. No, that's fair. Man, okay, last two questions here. And again, we're kind of at the point where we're bouncing around. We've definitely, I have, first of all, whatever your view of yourself is, this is some solid grade A wisdom. I mean, I just love this, Nick. This has been such a fun conversation so far. But let's talk about rural church transition, okay? And again, this conversation could be a podcast in itself. And when you talk about the journey of like how to have one pastor who then is done and there's another like that is a whole story. But you have managed after 9 years of serving in multiple roles to go full time as the youth director for the state. And you have managed to do pastoral transition on what I assume is a limited or semi-fixed budget. It's not like you could just afford to pay two lead pastor salaries and do the whole, because I think the problem with transition conversations when it comes to church leadership is that the books are being written by people who pastored churches where they could afford to literally bring on a whole second staff member for 4 years and then like do the whole 3 year handoff, you know, and it just was this whole thing. And so, whereas in a rural setting, like a lot of these people might be saying, hey, if I said tomorrow that I'm done, there might be like a 2 week notice, there might be a 6 month notice, there might be, but it's not like you can afford to necessarily bring in this pastor, have them study under you for a year. Like it's not always feasible. So maybe give us like, hey, if someone's approaching a change in lead pastor leadership, maybe spend 5 minutes telling us like what should guide that process, what's a practical nugget, how do we do it effectively, how do we do it cost effectively, just anything you want to hit in that window, go for it.
Rural ministry is not for the faint of heart, and it's a courageous
I
call.
always shudder when we start with that because I'm like, you're right, but whatever you're about to say sounds terrifying. Continue on.
Okay. And so there is a part, and I don't know, I feel like this needs to be said here, where you are gonna, and we believe, like in my context, my denominational movement, we believe men and women can be a ministry and all of
Yeah.
that. But by and large, in a rural context, especially, you know, in my context, I'm going to be looking for men to help men locally who are be that I get to disciple, I get to develop, and I'm saying, you know what, the call of God, let's bring out this call of God that we see happening in their lives. And so there's a part to that where not only are you humble and loving and you're a man of your word and obviously a man of God and you're abiding with Jesus and being led of the Holy Spirit, but you have a toughness and a grit that in a rural context, men respond to. But men in rural context, generally speaking, aren't going to follow someone who doesn't exhibit a toughness and a grit. And that's how you get those to follow you. But that being said, I tried multiple times to hire outside of our community, outside of our county. And I mean, obviously, it was going to be super creative. It was going to be very minimal salary, you know, bivocational. We'll help you find housing and I'll get you a job because I had connections, right? Just never worked. And I've got some cool stories of just no one dude that's in another state that I just think he's one of the best rural pastors ever. I mean, 300 to 400 people in his church, 3,000 people in the community, and he had money for staff and he couldn't bring anybody in. He couldn't pay enough to bring somebody in. So what we did to, and everybody's realizing this, or you know, you figure it out one way or another, you raise up from within. You raise up from within. And I missed the mark a couple of times. There was one young man that I wish I could have spent more time with. It's like almost like one that got away. And but then we had several others that were coming up. We started very gently letting them start leading by, you know, helping with Bible studies or at least leading in prayer or, you know, I mean, just the absolute bare minimum, so to speak. And because the fish are still in the cleaning process, but you see the call of God in their lives. And anyway, but I would say this, praying. You pray hard and you just depend on it has to be the Holy Spirit to help bring you people. And so the transition, man, we could talk forever, but the Lord helped us connect with a family that had the call of God, but had lots of mess. And we were able to walk with them through the mess, through the cleanup and into the call of God on their lives. And they were local in a missionary mindset, cross-cultural context. They were nationals. They were
local. Yeah. They were the indigenous people of
that
area.
They were the indigenous people of the area. And we were, by our prayer was, in a lot of ways, we thought when we were going to show up, I'm like, Lord, we're here forever. But if you want us to hand off this church eventually, may we hand it off? I always had it in my heart. I wanted to hand it off to somebody local, somebody indigenous, so to speak. And Lord allowed us to do that to the couple that we love dearly and love them. And they're going to do bigger and greater in Jesus' name. So, and that's who ended up being the senior pastors.
Well, and that's, I love that takeaway because, again, I think it's easy as pastors to say, well, who are we going to bring in? Who are we going to bring in? Who are we going to bring in? And instead, what it seems like you're describing is saying, hey, we didn't walk in with that mentality. We spent almost a decade creating a culture in our church of we are going to be the ones to call out pastors and to nurture the call of God and disciple people into leadership. And like,
yes.
Whether we like it or not, I think that's kind of our lot in life. You know, I think a lot of us would like to say, well, in a perfect world, we would be able just to pull somebody in from the outside, or we wouldn't have to do the work ourselves. But kind of the more I look at the church at large, and we'll kind of touch on this in the next question too, but like the more I look around, I'm like, I don't know that we have a lot of other options. Like, I don't know that there's that many people just floating in the wings of places, you know, looking to move to small towns, whereas you might have to really say, hey, this isn't just an option to raise from within. This might be the reality of just where we're at. And so as we enter our last question here, you know, we are going to zoom out a little bit to kind of your other hat that you now get to wear full time, which is the youth director for your region of Texas, because the number of Assembly of God churches in Texas is too many. So they divided it up into three. But you get a chance now to kind of look at all different walks of life at churches, bigger ones, smaller ones, big communities, small communities. And as I'm sure I've gotten the question, I'm sure you've gotten the question, wherever you go, people are saying, hey, how can I find or hire associate pastors? How do I find a youth pastor? How do I find a kids pastor? And so, again, give us that, you know, 3 to 4 minutes. Give us that big principle of like, if I'm a lead pastor of a small church, what is my most effective route to getting an associate? You know, like what's the route that you're finding from your seat in the chair, you know?
Yeah, you really, whoever the Lord has, I mean, whoever the Lord brings to you, you just have to steward that, period. Mm. And tooth and nail, you steward who the Lord brings. And we always, I mean, at our church, we always talked about most of the people that came into our church. We're an emergency room for a lot of people.
Sure.
And they're on the gurney getting ready to die. And and so we're there, we're stepping in. But even if it's a 15-year-old or a 27-year-old or a 47-year-old, whatever that looks like, you have to be ready. When we were on our way out, we had an older, more mature lady that had some background and made mistakes in life and whatnot. And I just, it's still to this day, I'm like, Lord, you got to call a God on her life. But what you have to do is step in, and you have to do it very deliberately, but you have to pull out. I mean, you're making disciples. We are called to make disciples, and disciple making is, in some sense, can almost be even a little bit easier in the rural context. You get your heart broke, and you don't have sure. Because you're right there in with it, you know. You get your heart.
There's no professional distance. Yeah.
Yeah. There's no professional distance in rural ministry at all, and it's not like you have like 20 college age guys and girls or like this that, you know, in previous ministries I had this one young or a couple of different young ladies who just like, I mean, just I'm like, oh my gosh, they're, Lord, you could use them to, you know, be president of the U.S. or lead. Yeah. You know, a multi-campus mega church in Jesus' name, right? And so, but in the rural context, it's whoever the Lord brings to you. And that means they may not have maybe a certain set of skills.
Right. They may not check every box that you would make on an ideal list, you know?
Yes. And so what you got to do is just cultivate what's in them, what God's placed in them, and cultivate that out. And our church, we had plenty of people that had spent time in either prison or jail. And that was like kind of our forte. And
I
so,
do love that.
yeah.
We're the
And
jail
so,
church.
yeah. So our what was our associate pastors that we brought along and are now the lead pastor of our church? They had Pastor Roman has a background in that world. And
I love
anyway, but any in all of that, you just whoever the Lord brings you develop, you disciple, you invest. And Jesus did it with the 12. And in rural ministry, that's what you're supposed to do because more than likely, you're not going to get anybody to move. But even in a rural geographic region where churches do have some money, where they may live in a town of 200,000 or a town of 70,000, right? They still are going to have challenges in bringing in staff. And so even with them, a lot of them are finding out, hey, whatever we got to do, I mean, hey, there's a 14-year-old kid. As long as his family stays going to this church, he goes to the youth group. Let's get him serving in kid ministry. Let's get him serving here. Let's make sure he's moving tables and chairs, and let's see where this goes. Because you just gotta, that's how you have to think in the geographic sense of what it means to do rural ministry, even if you're in cities.
Yeah, man, that is just such a that's such a beautiful picture. I think when we take this conversation we've had all together, it's a realization of like you're investing in the place you're at, and not only that, like God has called you to cultivate the call of God and the building of the kingdom of God in a place. And so, Pastor Nick, thank you for this conversation today, man. This was just so chock full of good stuff, and I know I have been blessed by it.
Well, thank you, Joe. It's from the Lord. It's all for the Lord. And my gratitude to you, my friend, and what you're doing for a rural ministry across the country. Anyway, it's just awesome. And I'm grateful to just be one of the individuals that gets to contribute, to this conversation. But thank you for gathering the conversations together and may this time bless somebody. And I know it's blessed me. And you and your wife. And anyway, thank y'all for all that y'all do.
Oh, absolutely. Well, from all of us at Rural Advancement, again, we are grateful that you've tuned into this conversation. We have conversations like this because we believe in the last point we just talked about, that the call of God is at work, calling people out of places, finding King David's in a field tending sheep. And so, again, from all of us, we hope that you feel equipped and empowered. We really do believe that God is at work in small, out-of-the-way places and that you are a big part of that. In a very formal sense, you can always check out this podcast on Spotify or Apple Podcast, leave us a rating or review. But true to the rural form, this podcast spreads not because we bumped it up on some algorithm, but because one rural leader looks at another and says, I've got some conversations that I think you should hear. And so I have been your host, Joe Epley. He has been Pastor Nick Rogers, and we will see you next week.